What's going on? Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the May 26th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Support for Takes on the World comes from our members and from the Anderson Valley Inn, offering lodging in the heart of Anderson Valley wine country. All the Valley's wineries, the Anderson Valley Brewing Company, and the Old Growth Redwoods in Hendy Woods State Park are within a 10-minute drive. Family and dog-friendly rooms available. Information at 895-3325 or avn.com. While strolling through the Mendocino Book Company a month ago, I came upon a new book on the Middle East that had just been published and of which I had not heard a word. It was the most comprehensive history of U.S. involvement in the Middle East that I had yet encountered, and in the several minutes that I spent looking through its 700 pages, I sense it to be an important contribution to our knowledge about a region that affects not only our lives, but that of virtually every person on the planet. The book was appropriately titled Quicksand, America's Pursuit of Power in the Middle East, and its author, Professor Jeff Warrow of North Texas State University, will be my guest today at about 20 minutes past the hour, when I hope to discuss as much of it as we can. And I'll be opening the phones for your calls in the latter part of the program. Until it's time to get Professor Warrow on the phone, let's look at some other news related and unrelated that you might not have heard. We'll start with a piece of legislation that you probably haven't heard about that originated with President Obama, who has earned a reputation for being overly generous with our tax money when it comes to rewarding his campaign donors. Many of those donors are key players in the pro-Israel establishment, what is euphemistically referred to as the Israel lobby. That lobby and the overwhelming majority of both houses of the U.S. Congress that follow its dictates have repeatedly expressed their displeasure over the past year at what they claim was Obama's hostility to Israel and to its Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when he attended the AIPAC convention in Washington in March. It eventually got to the point where, given the realities of the election season and the facts of life in Washington, the president has been forced to go out of his way in recent weeks to prove that he is just as loyal to Israel as any member of the U.S. Senate or House. And next week, I learned this morning, Netanyahu will make a return trip to Washington and be assured he will get the red carpet treatment. Obama's legislation, which is designed to protect Israel from rockets fired by Hezbollah and Hamas, was given the name United States-Israel Rocket and Missile Defense Cooperation and Support Act. That's right. It will provide $205 million to create what is being called an Iron Dome, which presumably would be more effective than the dome recently lowered into the waters of the Gulf by British Petroleum that failed to stem the oil leak. The bill passed the House by a vote of 410-4. That's right, 410-4 with 17 not voting. Only Democrats John Conyers, Dennis Kucinich, Pete Stark, and Republican Ron Paul had the guts and the sense of decency to vote against it. It will now go on to the Senate, where a 99-0 vote is a sure thing, since the only senator with the courage to challenge Israel lobby, West Virginia's Robert Byrd, is too ill to attend the sessions. Since this story has been totally blanked out by the media, apart from a handful of political blogs, I think you should hear some of the wording that those being paid to represent us, including Mike Thompson, used to justify their vote. Under a list of a half dozen so-called findings, we read that, quote, "The state of Israel has been under grave threat and frequent attack from missiles, rocket, and mortar shells fired at Israeli civilian targets by militants from the foreign terrorist organization Hamas," all in capitals, "on its southern border, and by the foreign terrorist organization Hezbollah on its northern border, which have killed, wounded, or inflicted psychological trauma on countless Israelis." That, quote, "The United States remains committed to Israel's qualitative military edge, including its advantage over non-state actors such as Hamas and Hezbollah, which boast increasingly sophisticated and powerful weapons as a result of support from Iran, Syria, and other state actors," end quote, and that, quote, "The United States can help to advance its own vital national security interests and the cause of peace by supporting Israel's ability to defend itself against rocket, missile, and other threats," end quote. It's an indisputable fact that the U.S. Congress has supplied Israel with the weapons of mass destruction that it has used to wage three bloody wars in Lebanon over the last 40 years. Those wars have resulted in the deaths of well over 20,000 civilians and the wounding and maiming of tens of thousands more. And it was the U.S. Congress that provided the weapons, including the white phosphorus with which Israeli forces leveled Gaza and killed 1,400 Palestinians, most of them civilians, less than 2 years ago. The House took its vote just as the Israeli military was beginning 5 days of massive exercises near the Lebanese border amid talk reported in the Israeli press that yet another war with its northern neighbor is inevitable. I have said it before and I will say it again. Each and every member of Congress who has voted for those Israeli weapons in one appropriation after another is an accessory to the crimes against humanity that Israel has committed with those weapons, and if there was any justice in this world, they would all be prosecuted as such. The House vote came only a few days before the exposure in the Guardian of London of heretofore secret South African documents revealing that Israel's current president, Shimon Peres, agreed to sell apartheid South Africa nuclear weapons in 1975, providing the first official proof that Israel actually possesses them. The top-secret minutes of meetings between senior officials in the two countries that year show that South Africa's defense minister, P.W. Botha, asked for the warheads, and Shimon Peres, Israel's defense minister at the time and now as president, responded by offering them in three sizes. The two men also signed a broad-ranging agreement governing military ties between the two countries that included a clause declaring that, quote, the very existence of this agreement was to remain secret. These documents, some of which were shown in The Guardian, were uncovered by an American academic, Sasha Polakoff-Saransky, while doing research for a book on the close relationship between the two countries. You may have heard him interviewed on Democracy Now! Yesterday, and I expect him to have a guest on my show in the near future. What was not mentioned in The Guardian article was the significance of the year 1975 in which the deal was signed. This was both the year of the Soweto Uprising and also of the collapse of the Portuguese Empire in southern Africa, represented by Mozambique and Angola. Almost all the genuine liberation movements at the time were supported by the Soviet Union, and there was concern that this region, with its vital mineral resources, might fall into Moscow's sphere of influence. I can assure you this evidence of Israel-South Africa collaboration will pass unnoticed by the U.S. Congress, even by members of the House Negro Caucus, all of whom but Conyers voted for the Israeli defense bill. Israel will also be counting on Congress to maintain its silence in the coming days when Israel plans to halt the international flotilla of boats that are bringing prohibited reconstruction materials and other supplies to the besieged people of Gaza. Nine ships under the banner Freedom Flotilla began their journey to Gaza on Saturday, despite warnings from Israel that they will be stopped for, quote, breaching Israeli law, end quote. The vessels are carrying 10,000 tons of reconstruction materials, school supplies, and medical equipment. The biggest of the nine ships set off from Istanbul, Turkey, heading to the southwestern city of Antalya, where two other Turkish ships will be waiting to join the convoy. The three ships will then travel to the waters of Athens and Crete to rendezvous with the other six before making the four-day journey to Gaza. Nahar Gonon, a senior Israeli foreign ministry official, told European diplomats last week that the plan to break Israel's naval blockade of the Gaza Strip was a quote-unquote provocation and would be stopped. This is a provocation and a breach of Israel law, Gallon told the ambassadors of Greece, Ireland, Turkey, and Sweden, whose nationals the ministry said were involved. Israel has no intention of allowing the flotilla to enter Gaza, Gallon was quoted as saying. Israel has maintained a strict blockade on Gaza since Hamas took power there in 2007. Last June, the Israeli Navy intercepted a ship carrying journalists and activists, including Irish Nobel laureate Mairead Maguire and former Congresswoman and Green Party presidential candidate Cynthia McKinney, and towed her to the southern Israeli port of Ashdod, where the two women and several other activists were placed under arrest. It elicited not a whimper of protest from McKinney's former House colleagues, including those in the House Negro Caucus. As I noticed in my last program, Turkey is a member of NATO, and its government is reported to be standing firmly behind the Turkish charity involved in the flotilla. any physical attempt by Israel that inflicts any damage on the Turkish boat or its passengers, or to that of the Greek and Irish boats that are also part of the flotilla, is quite likely to create international incident. Only then would the story of the Freedom for Gaza flotilla penetrate the locked gates of the mainstream media, which is only slightly less enthralled to the Israel lobby than is Congress. Turkey, of course, is now seen as a difficult ally in Washington, particularly after Prime Minister Erdogan and Brazilian President Lula da Silva negotiated a deal with Iran that would have Tehran shipping a major part of its uranium to Turkey for reprocessing for later use in nuclear reactors for medical purposes. The U.S. is hoping that despite the agreement, the U.N. Security Council will pass sanctions legislation against Iran that has been sufficiently watered down to gain the support of China and Russia. That isn't good enough for Israel's warriors in Congress, who hope to get a far stiffer sanctions bill passed and on the president's desk in the coming weeks, although apparently they're going to wait to see what the Security Council does. The American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, called on the Obama administration to embrace a congressional package as a complement to the multilateral sanctions. A statement released by AIPAC demanded that, quote, American and international sanctions on Iran must be overwhelming to change the dynamic within Iran and to alter the policies of Iranian leaders. Sanctions, it read, should target Iran's finance, insurance, shipping, transportation, natural gas, and manufacturing industries, in addition to Tehran's dependence on refined petroleum, end quote. We would move much closer to a more peaceful and just world by placing exactly those kind of sanctions on Israel. Excuse me. Meanwhile, a U.S. carrier strike force headed by the Harry S. Truman sailed out of Norfolk, Virginia on Friday towards the Persian Gulf with a strike group of 7 squadrons and 6,000 Marines and sailors. It is the first element of a new American military buildup in the Middle East, determined by Barack Obama. It will reach peak level of 4 to 5 aircraft carriers, most opposite Iranian shores in late July. The U.S. force will be joined by a German warship, the frigate FGS Hessen, operating under American command. The Israel lobby, to be sure, is not the sole owner of the U.S. Congress. It has to share that distinction with some other major interests, notably the major banks and Wall Street investment houses. There is, however, a considerable overlap between those other special interests and the Israel lobby, and that is one of the sources of the latter's power. But this last item is not about Israel, at least not directly. Jonathan Salant, writing for Bloomberg Businessweek on May 17th, reported that as, quote, the U.S. Senate was preparing to vote on legislation rewriting the rules for Wall Street, quote, the financial industry is holding fundraisers for lawmakers at a rate of almost one every business day this month. Some members of Congress have criticized Wall Street one month, Salant wrote, only to ask the industry for money the next. U.S. Representative John Adler, a New Jersey Democrat, demanded accountability from Wall Street in an April 29th statement. Last week, he held what was billed as, quote, a financial services dinner in Washington with a minimum contribution of $1,000. At least 20 House and Senate lawmakers schedule fundraisers this month targeting the industry or hosted by lobbyists for Goldman Sachs and Citigroup, among others, based on Democratic and Republican Party committee schedules sent to prospective donors. The event, Salant notes, allows lobbyists to mingle with lawmakers as the Senate debates sweeping new regulations for the industry. How hard are you going to be on somebody who's handing you money, said Bill Allison, an editor of the Sunlight Foundation, a Washington-based watchdog group. Not very is the answer. The legislation passed by the Senate is not nearly as tough as what was promised or what was needed, and you can give President Obama either the credit or blame for that, depending on whether you're a fat cat or an ordinary citizen. Obama was obstinate in making sure that the Depression-era Glass-Steagall Act, which was gutted under Clinton and which had prevented banks from using customers' deposits for reckless speculation, would not be revived, and the derivative dealings which the elimination of Glass-Steagall permitted and which brought on the economic collapse would not be banned. Nor did the president want the Federal Reserve to tell Congress, let alone the public, just who had received the billions of dollars in bailout money. And he was joined in that by Timothy Geithner, Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, Fed Chair Ben Bernanke, and the majority of members of the U.S. Senate who did not want the Fed subjected to congressional audit. On Monday, the Wall Street Journal summed up the situation in an editorial, noting that, quote, the Democrats who wrote the bill are selling it as a new discipline for Wall Street, but Wall Street knows better. The biggest banks support the bill, and the parts they don't like, they will lobby furiously to change or water down. Big finance, it went on, will more than hold its own with big government, as it always does, while politicians will have more power to exact campaign tribute. The losers are the overall economy as financial costs rise and taxpayers when the next bailout arrives. Close quote, the Wall Street Journal. And that brings me back to an observation by Mark Twain 101 years ago that the only native criminal class in America is Congress. He knew what he was talking about, but where are the Mark Twains of today? It is now 9:18, and time to get my guest Jeff Warrow on the phone. And while Jeffrey Warrow is a professor of military history at the University of North Texas and director of the university's Military History Center. His primary area of emphasis is modern and contemporary military history from the French Revolution to the present. He received his bachelor's degree magna cum laude from Brown University in 1983 and his master's in European history from Yale 4 years later. Before taking his position in North Texas, he taught military history at the Naval War College. Professor Warrow also hosted the History Channel's book show, Hardcover History, and was host and anchor of the History Channel's programs, History's Business, History vs. Hollywood, as well as Hard Target, Global View, and History in Focus. His fourth book, all 702 pages, including extensive footnotes, was just released by Penguin Press last month, entitled Quicksand, America's Pursuit of Power in the Middle East. And that's what we're going to be talking about with him today. Professor Warrow?
Yeah.
Good morning. Welcome to Takes on the World. I came across your book in one of our local bookstores just after it was released and was impressed not only by its scope, but the way you chose to tackle one of the most politically sensitive subjects, that being the Zionist movement, the role of Israel, and the powerful American organizations and institutions that support it. My first question is, why did someone who has made especially the relatively safe subject of European military history decide to step into the historical and political quicksand of the Middle East?
Well, that's a great question. I was teaching at the Naval War College, and after 9/11, we were encouraged to do a lot of research on U.S. and the Middle East and various security questions relating to that. And as I got involved in some of those projects, it occurred to me that what was really missing was the deep background and how we entered into the Middle East, what our motives were, whether they were understood or misunderstood. And so I started to look backward, and then as I did so, it just seemed that what was really needed was a much longer book that would cover America's entry into the Middle East from roughly the Woodrow Wilson administration down to the present.
Well, you certainly have broken some ground in doing that. One thing that I was very impressive was the access you had to British military files that I had not seen before, which paint a very different picture on a very critical moment in the Middle East, 1948, when Israel declared a state after the UN had voted partition, and there was a war between the new Jewish state and four Arab countries that had invaded it. And we have been told that those Arab countries were fighting a tiny little Israel, these besieged Jewish state. And in fact, you show that, in fact, the Goliath in the case was Israel and not the invading Arab armies.
Yeah, and that comes out pretty clearly in the archives, U.S. and British archives. But also in the work of revisionist Israeli historians like Benny Morris, who've done a lot of research and revealed that what was really going on in 1948. And what the archives tell you is that because there was an arms embargo clapped on all sides, victory would go to the state that was more inventive in procuring armaments, and the Palestinians were got basically no arms, and the big Arab countries that weren't subject to the arms embargo sent relatively small contingents into Palestine to try to crush out the Jewish state before it could get a foothold. So if you look at the actual numbers, the trained numbers of troops, the Haganah, which was the forerunner of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, it was very well armed, it was numerous, it was trained, and they had a sort of running business with the British mandate authorities, and they were buying arms off, stealing arms off them, bribing officials to get rifles, machine guns, Bren gun carriers, that sort of thing. So in the actual fighting of 1948-49, the Israelis were the larger, better-armed force.
Now, it's also interesting that although you mentioned Benny Morris, other newer historians like Alain Pape and Tom Segev and others have written about this in Israel, and books have been published in English. Basically, they have not really penetrated the American mind think. Israel is still portrayed as the victim, even though it's the fourth largest military in the world. And you seem to, in the book, place the United States between two competing poles. One, Israel, for domestic reasons, is supported, and the Saudis, because they sit on top of the huge oil reserves, is actually a strategic asset that has to be supported, and the U.S. has to make policies that placate both.
Yeah, I mean, the quicksand, the book, is sort of strung between two poles, Israel and Saudi Arabia. These are the two poles that we clung to as we advanced into the region. And Israel, for domestic political reasons, if you look at the emergence of our relationship with Israel from the Woodrow Wilson administration on, it was Wilson, the big proponent of national self-determination, was never comfortable with the Jewish state. He thought this was Arab land, and he sent the King Crane Commission, which traveled around the Holy Land and asked the inhabitants what kind of government they wanted, and you know, they discovered, of course, that it was largely Arab, and that they certainly didn't want a Jewish state, and they thought the Balfour Declaration was all wrong. Remember, and Quicksand really talks about the Balfour Declaration of 1917 at length. And this was a desperate British attempt to rally support inside the Central Powers, Germany and Austria-Hungary, to try to detach the Jewish populations of those two powers from their states and to try to diminish the contributions that Jewish bankers in both places were making to the war effort, buying, you know, Austro-Hungarian or German war bonds. It was also an effort to, as the Russian Revolution approached, to detach the Bolsheviks, many of whom were Jewish, by creating a Jewish state. And it was a British imperial effort to create a client state, a Jewish client state, on the edge of the Suez Canal, which was a key imperial asset. So the motives were definitely, you know, there was very little idealism embedded in the Balfour Declaration. And Woodrow Wilson saw that plainly, but he was prevailed upon by Justice Louis Brandeis, who said, look, you know, this is good politics. We've had a massive inflow of Jewish immigrants since the 1880s into the U.S., and you will lock in their support. Wilson was still hesitant, but ultimately he went along, and then each subsequent administration bought into that rhetoric, believing the Jewish lobby to be well-funded, to be influential. And, you know, I quote Harry Truman saying, when he's confronted by Secretary of State George Marshall and Secretary of Defense James Forrestal, who both say, look, it makes no strategic sense for the U.S. to throw its backing behind the small Jewish state when we have these broad international interests that compel us to make nice to the Muslim states around the world. And Truman says, look, gentlemen, I've got hundreds of thousands of constituents who are Jewish and very few Arabs among my constituents. He says, I'm going to, you know, plump for the Jewish state.
Well, I think you use the term bullying in your book, that the Zionist lobby has been essentially, as it has grown through the years, but even when it was limited to a number of influential individuals like Brandeis, for example, has been bullying U.S. presidents since Wilson's time.
Yeah, and this particularly rears up during the Harry Truman administration when he has what he calls his White House backroom boys, people like Eddie Jacobson and David Niles and Max Lowenthal, who are constantly inveighing against the State Department, against so-called Arabists in the State Department who want to see, just to see the U.S. take a more statesman-like position. And, John F. Kennedy has Meyer Feldman as his White House desk officer for Israel. This was a pretty rare position. You don't see any other countries getting a White House desk officer. And his job was to look at the political impact inside the U.S. of decisions that were made in the international arena by the U.S. government. And so each of these, and then certainly I talk about the LBJ administration, which really fell down during the Six-Day War and didn't rein in the Israelis, and hence the whole problem of the occupied territories. And the British embassy reports that this American passivity during the Six-Day War is owed to the influence of National Security Advisor Walt Rostow and senior State Department official Eugene Rostow. They were brothers. And the British comment on that was, the filling in the sandwich is pure kosher, meaning that the guys that were advising LBJ on the Six-Day War and on the Middle East in general were, diehard proponents of Israel.
Well, you've had this battle that went on, at least into the Clinton administration, in which the State Department, which was responsible for overlooking U.S. and securing U.S. national interests around the globe, whether anyone agrees with those interests or not, versus the Israel lobby, and the lobby actually was very open. I know AIPAC has put out brochures talking about how they have gotten Congress to stand up against the State Department. And that term Arabist, which has a racist pejorative to it, it's interesting. These are simply American officials who are looking out for U.S. interests, and because those interests happen to focus on securing the oil region for the United States, they were considered to be Arabists. And that term is still used to dismiss anybody who criticizes Israel in a beltway, no?
Oh, absolutely. And, certainly we saw this vividly during the George W. Bush administration, where, people like Ariel Sharon, Ehud Barak, criticized Colin Powell's State Department as being too friendly to the Arab states, and the neocons inside the George W. Bush administration sort of built a fence around the president and said, we're now in a war on terrorism, Israel is fighting its own war on terrorism, therefore it's part of the principal front in the war on terrorism, therefore it's a tight U.S. ally, and there was no reflection on the broader consequences of this. And there was no effort to separate what's going on in Israel and the occupied territories from this broader campaign against terrorism. The two are quite separate. Israel is still clinging to occupied territories. It's stonewalling the creation of a Palestinian authority and a Palestinian government. It's not delivering on promises it's made in the past. It's building settlements and strategic highways and checkpoints and that sort of thing. This is it's apples and oranges. But George W. Bush saw this in very, very simplistic terms, and that was very much the detriment of U.S. strategy and policy.
Well, his father took a very different position. I mean, in reading you have considerable amount of information, very important information about both Iraq wars, and particularly the role of the neocons in fomenting the second war, the current war. But I get the feeling that while the first war to get Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait did not have the same public support in the United States, I had the feeling, even though President Bush, the first President Bush, who had very close ties to the oil region, much closer than his son, really hoped that Saddam could be persuaded to withdraw without having the U.S. forces, and that even in the last moments he sent James Baker over there to try and convince Tariq Aziz to get Saddam Hussein to withdraw. And I know at the time Bush Sr. was being attacked in the The Washington Post and New York Times by leading supporters of Israel as being soft. And Bush Senior Bush also opposed the current Gulf War, as did Baker and Scowcroft. How do you size up the two Bushes and who this war, the current war in Iraq, was for?
Yeah, I mean, Quicksand talks a lot about this. It contrasts the two administrations, and it's interesting. You could say that Bush 41, that his administration was full of oil people, but so was the administration of Bush 43. I mean, you've got Dick Cheney, the CEO of Halliburton. You've got Condi Rice, who was on the board at Chevron. And so there was a lot of oil lobby influence in both administrations. And what's really striking is before we get into the Persian Gulf War of 1991, the approach both administrations took to the state of Israel. Baker, Secretary of State under Bush 41, was very skeptical about the Israelis and downright pugnacious when it came to the Israelis. He had a very clear view of what was going on. The same stonewalling we're seeing today from the Israeli government, building into East Jerusalem, building into the West Bank, expanding its highways and settlements. And then relying on AIPAC and other lobby groups inside the U.S. to silence Congress and intimidate the president. And Baker was pretty feisty on this. You know, he gave a press conference about it, and he said, "Look, here's the White House phone number, Israel. If you want to talk to us and you want to start making concessions and start arriving at a final settlement and peace in the Middle East, give us a call." And it was regarded as a real slap. Now, you saw nothing of the sort under Bush 43. People who were skeptical about the Israel lobby and its impact on U.S. strategy and policy were, you know, pushed to the sidelines, and there was just this full-throated belief that we needed to be, you know, stand shoulder to shoulder with the Israelis in this global campaign against terrorism. And so Bush 41 had much, much, much finer grasp of the realities in the Middle East and also the requirements of U.S. policy, the need to be an honest broker and be a real statesman and balance the various constituencies. And what it really comes down to is forcing the Israelis to, you know, to cut loose the occupied territories and stand up a Palestinian state that can govern the growing, you know, Palestinian population. And in terms of the war of 1991, what Quicksand points out is, you know, I think we still have this triumphalist vision of what happened, that we went in there and we just, you know, thrashed the Iraqis, and indeed we did, but the prelude to that was nerve-wracking. I mean, Bush 41 really worried that he'd be impeached. He had no Democratic support for that war. You had people like Senator Pat Moynihan or Senator Ted Kennedy that were predicting, you know, 50,000 casualties, and where people like Moynihan were saying, you know, why are we fighting a war to support a bunch of rich Kuwaiti princes who are sitting around in Hiltons and Sheratons in Riyadh while U.S. troops are in there getting killed? And so Bush did worry about impeachment, and there was a real divide inside his administration between hardliners like the National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft and Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney on the one hand, and then people like Baker on the other hand, who were saying, you know, this is pretty dicey, and it doesn't, and certainly the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Colin Powell, said, you know, American people don't want their kids dying for $1.50 a gallon gasoline. He said, you know, the best thing to do is let Iraqis absorb Kuwait. They'll still have to pump and sell the oil. Why are we going to commit U.S. forces to this? So the book looks, in a couple of chapters, it looks very closely at the run-up to war, and it shows how George H.W. Bush was quite courageous. I mean, he went against prevailing opinion, against Congress, against the media. He stood up for what he regarded as a vital American interest. He was backed in this, of course, by Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. But it was to look back in retrospect, it makes you realize that the war was regarded as a near-run thing, and it took a great deal of courage by George H.W. Bush to wage it.
Well, although AIPAC did not take official position, reportedly in the Washington Jewish Week at the time, key AIPAC officials were actually pushing for that war, and what they did was they hoped and they thought that Saddam Hussein would be removed from power, and evidently when he wasn't, Bush started getting attacked for being soft and leaving Saddam. But his reasoning was he didn't want to destabilize the region and hand Iraq to Iran, which in a sense...
Yeah, I mean, the post-war was as interesting as the pre-war in 1991. The debate you had inside the administration to push on to Baghdad and remove Saddam Hussein or to stop at the highway of death and... permit an armistice, and it was it's incredible the conversations people like Schwarzkopf and Cheney were having. And they all agreed across the board that to go on to Baghdad would stick the United States as if in a tar pit, that we'd be there, as Schwarzkopf said, we'd be there for decades after the fact. And Cheney said the same thing. He said, there's no point in going to Baghdad. We've lost enough lives. We've achieved our objective. Why do we want to go on and sort of occupy a country and have to take care of the rebuilding of the country? It was just tremendous irony when you think about the breezy ease with which Cheney took the country to war in 2003. There was a really interesting post-war debate, and as I said, they all agreed. The only dissenter, the only one who wanted to go on to Baghdad, was a senior official in the Pentagon named Paul Wolfowitz.
You actually have some interesting information on Wolfowitz, the influence that he had going back before the current before the Bush administration, writing defense policy. Even though he was like an undersecretary, he was one of the most important factors, along with another neocon, Douglas Feith, and another one, Richard Pearl, in kind of orchestrating the current Gulf War.
Yeah, and you know, there's a real Wolfowitz's influence extends from the Carter administration onward, and you know, it's incredible because he sees, starting in the 1970s, Wolfowitz sees Iraq as being the really threatening heavyweight. He sees that Iranian power has been significantly diminished by the fall of the Shah and the advent of sanctions. So he thinks that that Iran's going to be useless as a check and balance, and he wants a much sterner policy toward Iraq. The irony, of course, is that you know, in the 70s and 80s, Wolfowitz is thinking in terms of balance and power. He's worried that the cratering of Iranian power after the Iranian Revolution, when the Shah's multi-billion-dollar arsenal kind of runs out of fuel and parts and everything and is starved of other resources, he worries that there'll be an imbalance there. But then he achieves the exact same effect by collapsing Iraqi power in 2003 and leaving a resurgent Iran as the peerless regional heavyweight that now threatens American interests there.
It's interesting that you mentioned in the book about the clean break that three other neocons were involved with, Richard Pearl, Douglas Feith, and David Wormser and his wife Mirav. They wrote this clean break, which was a prescription for Benjamin Netanyahu to take out Saddam Hussein, among other things. And that group kind of flowed into Project for New American Century with the same goal. Maybe you could talk about that a bit.
Yeah, clean break was subcontracted to the men who became the principal neocons in the 1990s. It was a plan for the Likud. Distinguish itself from labor and other opponents inside Israel, all of whom were clinging, to the peace process and negotiating and trying to arrive at some sort of a settlement with the Palestinians and a final settlement. And Clean Break said, no, let's make a clean break. This business of negotiating with the Palestinians is endless and ultimately serves no purpose because we can never get to an agreement. Why don't we just, hit them as hard as we can with all we've got and intimidate them, batter them down, and make clear to the surrounding frontline states that they can't play a role in this either because Israel is too well-armed, has too tight a relationship with the United States. And so we'll use force instead of persuasion to arrive at a final settlement. Once they're beaten down so badly, they realize they have no hope, they'll accept whatever crumbs we sweep off the table for them. That was the essence of Clean Break. And what's really scary is that the authors of Clean Break, people like Pearl and Feith, then become principals in the George W. Bush administration. And they become great strategists, in terms of inserting American power into the Middle East and broadening American power. And yet, I don't think it's putting too fine a point to say they're essentially lapdogs of the Israeli government. And Americans have to ask themselves, are these the sort of people we want plotting the strategy of the United States government? They were serving two masters, and one of them was extremely injurious to American interests in the region. It's one thing to say, yes, we defend the right of Israel to exist, we're allies with Israel, and we want to discourage aggression in the region, we want to discourage these governments to annually pledge to drive Israel into the seas. That's something that nobody argues about. But these are broader Israeli aims for a greater Israel. and keeping the Palestinians in bondage that the United States simply can't align itself with, and yet we do.
My guest is Jeffrey Warrow, Professor Jeffrey Warrow. I'm going to open the lines in about 5 minutes. I want to get to a really key point, and I brought it up, I referred to it before. But, you know, AIPAC and Israel supporters, as well as some of its leading critics, such as Noam Chomsky, explain that Israel receives all this massive unconditional support that it does because it is a strategic asset for the United States and the Middle East, our battleship, our cop on the beat, and so on. But one can reasonably come to the conclusion, looking at the evidence you provide in your book, that it's more of a liability, and but one that, for domestic political reasons, Washington is forced to live with.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I quote a pro-Israel esteemed historian of the Middle East, Bernard Lewis, who, during the 1991 Persian Gulf War, he looks at the amount of energy expended by the U.S. government to restrain the Israelis when the Israelis are itching to get into the fight and join their forces to the coalition fighting Iraq. And we spend our entire time sending people like Paul Wolfowitz to hold Israel's hand and pull them back and assure them that we'll find the Scuds and we'll knock them out, and we send Patriot batteries and we do everything in our power to restrain the Israelis despite their tremendous arsenal. And Lewis says, that war alone proves that Israel's not a strategic asset to the United States. It's a strategic liability. And look what's going on with the Iranian nuclear program right now. I mean, the U.S. is actually is trying to rein in the Israelis, understanding that an Israeli attack on Iran will inflame the region. You've got people like former Carter National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski saying, you know, if the Israelis try to fly a mission into Iran, U.S. fighters in Iraq are going to have to scramble and shoot them down. I think there's no better commentary on the lack of force that Israel actually adds to us in the region than that. And you have to just sort of say, what do they achieve for us? They nothing but headaches. Again, this is not to say they don't have a right to exist or we shouldn't be allied with them. It's to say that we have to take a very clear-headed view of politics there and feelings there and what it takes to implant American influence there on a long-term basis.
I know you recently also followed up. I had an article I saw and found on the internet in which you have the title is "No Better Friend: America, Israel, and the Occupied Territories," and which you make a joke about that, and quoting Joe Biden, who has never who is one of Israel's best friends in the U.S. Senate for years. And you write this article critical of Israel, and you call on Obama to get tough, but you say in the end he probably won't because he doesn't want to pick a bruising fight with a lobby when he needs the same Congress to push through his legislation.
Absolutely. I mean, it was striking when Biden had that dust-up with the Israeli government, and then when Obama inserted himself into the discussion and took a very hard line. You know, the next day you see Bibi Netanyahu in Washington with his arm around Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid. And they're slapping him on the back and grinning at the cameras. And it's sort of like the quote I gave from Truman. You know, I have lots of Jews among my constituents and very few Arabs. And so they're playing this for the domestic political bounce. As members of Congress, they don't have that much invested in American strategy. They're much more interested in getting reelected and getting their colleagues reelected, and so they know how to play the Israel question. And so it's and Obama, for his part, whatever his goals, he has to massage Congress in order to put together the votes to pass stimulus or pass health care or pass other things. And also, it's just sort of support for Israel is kind of a third rail. If you take a really hard line, you're going to get burned. And yet, somebody has to do it. That's why I wrote Quicksand, because I wanted to look back over the critical junctures when various presidents confronted this question. And some of them confronted when it was really easy to solve. I mean, if you look back at FDR, you look at Harry Truman, John F. Kennedy, Eisenhower, it was pretty easy to solve back then. The situation hadn't become as fraught as it is now. numbers of Palestinians hadn't become as high as they are now. The demographic bomb wasn't as pressing as it is now. And yet each of them succumbed to the siren call of the Israel lobby. They refused to press their early determination home. They all came in saying, we've got to do something about this. We've got to create a Palestinian state. We've got to disoccupy the occupied territories. And yet ultimately they all caved for domestic political reasons.
Well, this, you know, you at the end of your book, you tell us that America has to break a lance for those Palestinians. But the way the situation is in Washington, it appears to be Israel's most important occupied territory.
Well, yeah, I mean, you mean Washington or?
No, Washington is Israel's most important occupied territory.
Well, that's a very good way of putting it. And I mean, you see some rethinking going on right now. But you know, it's striking during that dispute between Biden and Netanyahu. Organs like the Fox News Channel were fond of saying that Israel is more popular in the U.S. today than Obama. You know, the approval rating for the state of Israel is higher, and I think that. You know, certainly there's a lot of lobbying involved, but I think there's just a great deal of complacency on the part of American citizens who haven't looked too closely at this question and looked at the history of this question. And, you constantly hear people say, well, it's the only democracy in the region. Well, you know, if you were getting billions of dollars of U.S. aid every year, you'd be on better footing than a relatively threadbare state like Syria. This is not to say the Syrians run their affairs well, or the Egyptians, or the Jordanians, for that matter. But they're not getting these multi-billion-dollar handouts every year. They're not getting 80% of their massive defense establishment paid for by the U.S. taxpayer every year. So, you know, when you see people, you know, writing books like Startup Nation and lauding, you know, the Israeli success story, yeah, they are successful, but they've had an awful lot of help. And when you talk about their democracy, the current government right now, with this Lieberman guy in charge of the foreign ministry, taking a very hard line with an inflammatory line with the Palestinians in order to, you know, coalesce the right-wing ultra-Orthodox parties. What kind of democracy is that, and what kind of partner is that for the United States that everywhere else seems committed to democracy and secularism and human rights and that sort of thing? So I don't think there's much deep thinking on this question. People are captive to their past assumptions, and one of the reasons I wrote the book and got sort of excited about it as I got into the conclusion was that, you know, I think it's time to start rethinking it.
Well, one of the things that bothered me, puzzled me, is when I found your book in the bookstore and was happy to find it there, that I hadn't heard about it. I have seen no reviews about it, and one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you on the air about it is because when you take a line that you do, and it's a very fair approach. Because you talk about the suffering of Jews during the World War II, that you have now treaded on the third rail yourself, and either will be banned from being reviewed because you tell the truth, and this is on the subject that the truth is in short supply, as you mentioned yourself.
Yeah, and it is curious that things like the New York Times Book Review haven't reviewed it. Magazines like the New Yorker haven't reviewed it or even put it in their, you know, books, recent books of interest, you know, the little short bits. Washington Post did it on its online edition, but not on its print edition. And I find that curious. You know, I don't want to succumb to conspiracy theories, but you know, for a book as well-researched as this, that takes a historical look back at America's involvement with the Middle East that comes from a major trade publisher, Penguin Press, I do find that curious.
The book, by the way, is Quicksand, America's Pursuit of Power in the Middle East. It's 702 pages. We have a couple of calls. The number here is 895-2448 or 1-800-499-7117. Let's go to the first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, 2 points. First, it always amazes me when people talk about Israel as being a democracy. I mean, you basically have to draw the lines around the West Bank and Gaza Strip. So you have people that have lived there for thousands of years who can't vote in the government that controls their everyday lives. That doesn't fit my definition of a democracy. So it just truly amazes me when I hear that. And the other is, I'd love to hear more about the conclusions in your book, what we ought to do, how we can do it.
Thanks for calling. Yes, good question. Okay.
Well, the I agree with you that, and I think that Israel's situation with the Palestinians today is a great threat to Israel's own democracy. I mean, that was a statement made by Ehud Barak a month or two ago when he said, look, it's in our own interest to create a Palestinian state as quickly as possible to relieve pressure on our own democracy by the Palestinian minority within, which is growing faster than the Jewish population, but also the surging Palestinian population around us, which exists in this sort of occupied state without rights, without jobs. And so Barak, who seems to be a lot more statesmanlike than the Likud, is, saying what is pretty obvious. And as for conclusions, I'm not a prophet, but after sketching the history, I say, look, one of the reasons I wrote the book was to look back at past administrations and see what they did, and they all punted. And so I say, it's time for somebody to really bear down and arrive at some sort of a final settlement to use America's tremendous leverage. This is something that, one of the interesting things about contrasting British and U.S. archives in researching this book is the British, who had had an imperial role in the past and then surrendered it, around about the 1950s and 60s, they knew what it was to, to exert leverage over weaker states. They were always thunderstruck by the lack of force inside the U.S. They say, here's a case where the tail is always wagging the dog. You've got the United States, the 600-pound gorilla, being pushed around by this little puppy Israel. And they understood why, but they thought it was just a complete collapse of American strategic thinking and a complete collapse of U.S. authority in a critical part of the world. So, I conclude that it's time for somebody to sort of drive this thing home and really pull the parties together and exert pressure on Israel and certainly on the Palestinians as well. The Palestinians have frequently been their own worst enemy. But I think in the West Bank, we have a pretty good team of players who are eager to do the right thing. And Hamas obviously presents problems in Gaza, but I think the Israelis, one of the points I make in the book is that, Sharon very deliberately spun off Gaza in 2005 and dressed it up as a concession. He said to the George W. Bush administration, look what I'm doing. I'm giving up Gaza and I'm giving it to the Palestinians. Well, he had no hope in Gaza. The population was growing so fast. The misery index there is so high with the overcrowding and the joblessness. What were they going to do with their little handful of settlers there? So they had to give it up, and then he dresses that up as a concession. And when Hamas came to power in elections there, the Israelis were overjoyed because they could say, look, you see, we give these guys independence, we give them a degree of independence, and they vote in a bunch of terrorists. Well, the conditions there are so vile that I think anybody would vote in a bunch of terrorists, and anybody would accept any aid, even Iranian aid, just to sort of get out of that misery. So it's the situation gets worse and worse and worse. And I find it infuriating, the attitude of the Netanyahu government and, again, the passivity of the U.S. government in not using the tremendous leverage it has to wrestle them into some kind of settlement. That said, it's very difficult to do. What if Obama wants to make some bold initiative in Israel-Palestine? What exactly is he going to do? Congress is going to leave him in the lurch, absolutely positively. They're going to be heavily lobbied. The media is going to be blaring about this, how Obama's appeasing terrorists and appeasing an Iranian ally. It's just a lose-lose for him. So the book ends on a rather pessimistic note in that regard. It exhorts American leadership to be leaders. But given the way we're constituted, it's hard to see a realistic way forward. And as for Saudi Arabia, it's our gas pump, and it's a vital U.S. interest. But it's we continue to sort of dance around with them and ignore the ill effects of Wahhabism and the resentment building inside the kingdom against the U.S., against the royal government itself. And I don't see that there's any real solutions have been taken there. I mean, the U.S. has had opportunities over the decades to try to modernize that country, to move the kings and princes toward a more modern and democratic society. And each time we've just lapsed into complete passivity because we're content to get the oil out. So I say, 9/11 certainly demonstrated that something needs to be done about that.
Well, Professor Warr, we actually come to the end of the hour. I should tell you, I reported this morning that Netanyahu is going to take another visit to Washington next week, and he'll probably get the red carpet. I very much appreciate you being our guest today on Takes on the World. The book is Quicksand, America's Pursuit of Power in the Middle East. Author is Jeffrey Warro, W-A-W-R-O, and I know it is in at least one local bookstore. Go out and get it. It is 702 pages of the most the information, much more than we could have covered this morning. But thank you very much again for being our guest today.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Our pleasure. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And that was Professor Jeffrey Warro. And now you heard it on KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Wilson, Ukiah, and 88.1 FM Fort Bragg. The time is 10 o'clock, and stay tuned for Earth and Sky, and then we will go to interlude with Patrick Gomes in Mendocino.